This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Robert Siegel, sitting in for Neil Conan, who's out sick today, and we are broadcasting today from Fort Dix in New Jersey. And just 15 miles north of here, about 1,200 American men and women face off against Iraqi insurgents. Or they come the closest you can to that experience in New Jersey. They're in what is called the FOB, the Forward Operating Base at Fort Dix. It includes a mock Iraqi village called Balad, where soldiers learn to avoid ambushes, to identify improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, and defend off Arabic-speaking Iraqis who are armed with AK-47s. The point of this, of course, is to prepare these soldiers for war. Most of them will be leaving for Iraq or Afghanistan within the next few months. Since September 11th, 2001, some 93,000 National Guard and Army Reserve troops have trained here at Fort Dix before shipping out. Do they leave here prepared for the tasks that lie ahead? We've come here to find out how those men and women get ready for war, and later in the program, we'll hear about some laughter on the front line. Stand-up comedian Tom Irwin entertains the troops in Iraq, and he'll perform for us here at Fort Dix. But first, shipping out. If you have shipped out to Iraq or Afghanistan, or if you'll be shipping out soon, what was your mobilization experience like? Were you well prepared for the mission? If a relative of yours is fighting overseas or shipping out, what support have you received, or what support do you wish you had received? Our number, as always, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is talk@npr.org. Today, we'll talk with current and former military commanding officers. We're here in the Timmerman Center Auditorium at Fort Dix. And joining me on stage are Colonel Douglas Dinan, who is Deputy Commander for Mobilization at Fort Dix. Welcome to the program, Colonel Dinan.
Thank you, sir.
General Michael Davidson, a retired Major General in the Army, former Assistant to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for National Guard Matters. Welcome to you, Mike Davidson.
Good to have you back. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Colonel Dinan, first, I'm going to start with you. The soldiers who are training at that forward operating base I described, what are they actually doing?
Well, sir, on a broader scope, the training is the most important tenet that we have here, but there are three other tenets that take place as well. Personal administration, medical, dental, and logistics is a very big play, too. So those four areas couple with how we validate a unit for deployment. So the training perspective out at our forward operating base, they will experience there probably about three-quarters of the time that they're here at Fort Dix, and they will be going through individual training that spans 41 individual tasks and 11 battle drills. And that combines the entire training scenario that they face. Our focus here is train as we're going to fight. It's theater immersion training, capitalizing on the Iraqi Americans who speak Arabic, capitalizing the warrior trainer program, with the recent combat experience. Those are our primary trainers. And it's a collective environment that instills the warrior ethos.
It's that odd mix of theater in the military sense and theater in the sense that it's there are people acting the part of Iraqi insurgents as our people are training here.
Yes, sir. And if it's it's really evolved over the last 4.5 years while we've been doing this, it's really light years beyond what it was like in 2001, 2002, 2003. So it's tough to compare what we did 2 years ago with what today because it's generations beyond.
Well, as we read and hear every day in the news, what's happening in the war zones is changing all the time. How quickly can you keep your training regimen changing to reflect what experiences our troops will have over there?
Well, sir, as General Honore says, the war over there changes every 3 months. We've got Colonel Miklos's 72nd FA Battalion is here. They've got 450 trainers on the ground. They're constantly being infused by the latest combat experience into their organization. So it's constantly being updated, as well as weekly feedback from theater.
How do you deal with the peculiar problem of the war in Iraq right now, which is especially dealing with reservists and members of the Guard who are, these are civilian soldiers. We all know that public and political support for the war has been plummeting for the past year. How does it affect, or in any way, if it does, change your mission?
Sir, our mission here remains focused. It remains focused, and so does the training in terms of the theater immersion training. We have the pleasure to really see the depth of America as it comes in here from the various states. So far this year, we have trained and deployed over 8,000 soldiers. And I see 20 to 40% of them are volunteers for the second tour or third. Mm-hmm. The attitudes are tremendous. It's out there. It's really a credit to this unique breed that steps forward.
So you're saying whatever is happening with support out there in a political sense, you're not feeling it in terms of people's readiness to come back and to serve.
Sir, I think these young men and women see beyond that.
General Mike Davidson, when these young men and women come out of training at a place like the Forward Operating Base and the entire experience of Fort Dix, are they prepared for war?
I don't know if you can get anybody really prepared. These folks are doing a wonderful job with the training, and they're moving to the ends of the earth to make it happen. But when the first time you get shot at, things kind of come apart. And the best thing I think we have going for us is a high-quality young man and woman that we have coming in the service, active guard and reserve. They'll get each other through that first combat event, and then it gets you get more proficient quickly.
To the extent that you can be trained before going over to experience what you're going to experience, what are the most important things that you think a soldier should learn before shipping out?
Well, first they have to get very good at their job. And you have a military occupation specialty, and they get very good at that. But most importantly, that gives them the confidence to go into an alien culture, an alien environment. There's nothing in the United States that prepares you for combat anywhere in the world. So it's that it's a high-quality individual coming in. The right leaders make a big difference, and then they get each other through the lot.
Colonel Dinan, do they get to use the very same equipment, the very same weapons here that they will be using over there?
Yes, sir. We have, in terms of collective tasks to be able to move, shoot, and communicate, the units that we specialize here in the security forces, individual equipment, crew-serve weapons, communication systems, night vision devices, yes. Here we have a different rolling stock, though. We've got training sets equipment that comes from the various states and Army Reserve. They train on that rolling stock that stays here because they fall in under 44 up-armored Humvees in theater. So the rolling stock is the one variable that's a little bit different.
Now, at this particular moment in your life, you're a colonel here in the reserves.
Yes, sir.
At other times, you're an executive at GE.
Yes, sir.
Are you a better colonel for being an executive at GE or a better executive at GE for being a colonel?
I think it works both ways, sir. This is my second tour. First one was in 0102.
And the second tour at Fort Dix.
Yes, sir.
Doing training.
And what's interesting is I bring from GE the experience to help run this system better, and conversely with my experience here running this large operation, I can leverage that back at GE as well.
Well, Colonel Dinan and General Davidson, let's hear from caller Gary, who's in Kansas. Gary, go ahead. Gary, I'm sorry.
We immediately adjust fire, should I say, to what was going on at that time, and then we disseminated that information back to the Conus area.
Can you be a little bit more explicit about that? What changes when something like that happens? What's Kerry referring to, Colonel Dinan?
In the beginning, sir, it was more of the lanes training concept, the TRADAC approach that we had at that time in 0102. And it's evolved significantly, incorporating lessons learned from the battlefield and the whole concept of theater immersion training. Granted, the units are at the mobilization station a little bit longer, but they're coming out far better trained for the deployment.
Okay, Mike Davidson, you've been out of the service longer, so in more non-military speak, what's Colonel Dinan telling us?
Soldiering is a people business. Creighton Abrams, the general for whom we named the tank, used to say that people are not in the Army, people are the Army. And, Kerry, I'd be interested if you're still on the line, if you agree with this, but a squad will be good because the sergeant that's running the squad is very good. And that sergeant will stay in the Army because he wants to look after the young kids that will go on the next tour with him. So this is a people business, and people get smarter. They send those lessons back. But we have an institutional memory in the Army that isn't part of the training schedule. It isn't part of the system. It's not dealt with in the Pentagon. but it works with our soldiers in the field.
Okay, Carrie, thanks for calling. We've talked about training. Does that sergeant who's been out there, does he come back for retraining at some point? Do people go through this experience more than once, Colonel Dinan?
Yes, sir, they do. When we have the 30 to 40% soldiers that return back for the second tour, they did have that experience 2 to 3 years ago. They go back through the entire 41 and 11, as we call it, for the individual training and collective. They bring a tremendous value of experience with them, but we also infuse the latest from the scenario in theater.
The latest. How quickly, if a new kind of improvised explosive device or a bomb, a new kind is set off in Iraq, how soon before that's incorporated into the experience here in New Jersey?
Sir, out at the forward operating base, there are we call them battle update briefings. They occur, and we get weekly feedback from theater, and I would say within 72 hours.
Within 72 hours,
yes, sir.
You might have somebody introducing a scenario that involves a bomb of that kind here for training purposes.
Yes, sir. We address that type of instruction and feedback. We see that twice a week.
General Davidson, when you were active, how long a turnaround might that have been before an experience in the field made it into a training cycle?
Oh, several years.
Several years.
This is a precision battlefield, and it's the pace is a lot quicker now, and we're dealing with, again, very high-quality soldiers and, I think, very capable senior leaders.
I was struck in looking at the videos here at Fort Dix about training, how many people are working, as we all work in so much of American life today, at a computer. I was trying to imagine, Colonel Dinan, what the IT bill is for the training services here at Fort Dix. Must be colossal.
Well, sir, in my other life, I'm a taxpayer as well.
Well, thanks for pointing that out, Colonel Douglas Dinan, who is Deputy Commander for Mobilization at Fort Dix, the scene of our broadcast today of Talk of the Nation, also joining us in this hour discussing training of our forces, of our soldiers to go over and fight, is Major General, retired Major General Michael Davidson, who used to be the assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for National Guard Matters. And we will continue this discussion in just a couple of minutes here on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Robert Siegel, sitting in for the ailing Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from Fort Dix, New Jersey. Fort Dix has been training soldiers for war since 1917. Of course, a great deal has changed since those days, and we are here to talk about how soldiers train for current conflicts, especially the war in Iraq. Our guests are Colonel Douglas Dinan, who's Deputy Commander for Mobilization here at Fort Dix, and also retired Major General Michael Davidson, who is former assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for National Guard Matters. And we also hope to hear from you, those of you in our audience here at the Timmerman Center and those of you listening on the radio, especially if you've shipped out to Iraq or Afghanistan, or if you will be shipping out soon, tell us what your experience was like. Were you well prepared for it? You can give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is talk@npr.org. And now a question from a member of our audience here at Fort Dix. Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon. My name is Caroline Germond. Colonel Dinan, you mentioned capitalizing on Arabic speakers, if I understood you correctly. Would you please talk about any language training that you provide here at the base and or cultural sensitivity, cultural awareness provided to our troops? Thank you.
Colonel Dinan, yes.
Yes, ma'am. Part of the training, and it's an extremely important part, part of the theater immersion training, is the use of what we call civilians on the battlefield. And they are part of real-world injects that occur not only throughout the day, but in the evenings, too, at the entry control points. So that is something that the units, the soldiers, experience every day that they're here out at the forward operating base. Part of the training they experience, too, is language training, country orientation, and cultural awareness. All that is embedded part of their individual and collective training.
We all know there was a finding restated in the Iraq study group that over there in Baghdad, I think out of 1,000 staffers at the embassy, they're in, I think, high single digits for fluent Arabic speakers. It's a terrible shortage that we have. General Davidson, what do you think about that problem?
It's been a problem. It's going to be a problem. Americans are traditionally poor at foreign languages. And I'm from Kentucky, and we struggle with English. So that's not going to get any better. We can spend money and we can spend time on it, but it's going to get some better, but not a lot better.
The State Department actually does rank languages by difficulty, and Arabic is not one of the easy ones to learn, so it is a challenge. Another question from a member of our audience here at Fort Dick. Sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Joe Chirico. I'm from Massapequa Park, New York. Sir, both General and Colonel Dinan, can you tell us what you think that Congress or the American people can do to make your job easier here as you're training your soldiers to go to war?
I'll take a shot at that, let me prepare you. This is probably not the answer you were looking for. We learned after Vietnam that you can separate the war from the warrior. You can question the policy on the war without having to question the admiration, the magnificent commitment and courage of the men and women in uniform. So as we talk about issues of the White House and the Congress's role in policy, I think it's worth remembering that we still hold our young men and women in uniform in very high regard. One of the things that Congress can do for the people in uniform, and one of the things that they can do in the White House and should do more in the Pentagon, is question the policy. Hold defense leaders accountable. And NPR benefits from that because they get things to put on the air, but the soldiers benefit more because we come up with a better policy if we don't accept what we're doing just because we did it 6 months ago.
Sometimes when generals or even retired generals say that, they're thinking of civilian officials at the Department of Defense. Are you thinking of generals as well?
Not really, because I did my last 6 years in the Pentagon, which will indicate to those of you that are familiar with that assignment pattern that I made somebody really, really mad. And in 6 years, I saw both Secretary Rumsfeld and two other Secretaries of Defense and a couple of chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Generals do what civilians tell them. They stay in their lane. They stay in their box. And civilian control of the military is so ingrained, it's not even considered, much less questioned. So the last time a general who was a personal hero of mine went into the White House and told the president that he was having a really dumb idea was Matthew Ridgway in 1954 about bailing out the French at Dien Bien Phu. And since then, we've had secretaries of defense and national security advisors really micromanaging the process.
A question from one of the members of the audience was submitted in writing. A large number of trainers, this person says, at Fort Dix have never been in theater. What are you doing to address this, Colonel Dinan?
So that's actually changed over the last 4 years. If we've got 450 trainers on the ground right now, part of Colonel Miklos's brigade, I think the number is about 220, 225 that are part of the warrior trainer program. So why that mindset existed 2-3 years ago, it's really no longer the case today. The internal embedded observer controllers that are with each of the units that are here at Fort Dix, many of them have recent combat experience, and this has been changing and improving continuously.
Another question from a member of the audience here at Fort Dix. Sir.
I'm John McKee. I'm from Fairfield, Connecticut. Sir, what type of benefits can Army Reserve or Reserve Component soldiers expect for going the extra mile nowadays? Specifically, I'm looking at earlier retirement and some benefits for the future.
John, I can answer that. What we know today, and the benefits have been getting better in terms of medical, dental. The retirement question is a good one. Today it still resides for the reserve components at age 60. There's a lot of discussion in Congress, and we hope it continues as such, where tenure for Operations Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom may offer the opportunity to have that start at below age 60. We certainly think that the benefits packages, while they are changing, need to continue to change to meet today and tomorrow's war versus yesterday's.
Our number, 800-989-TALK. Caller now, Steve in Portland, Texas.
Hi, I just feel that a lot of soldiers aren't well trained when they
Steve, you're going to have to turn your... No, we can't handle it. Steve had his radio on. That was not a speech defect. Steve had his radio on, and it was echoing back through the system, and we couldn't manage with him. The question about reservists is one we're going to, or the special problems is one we're going to return to a bit later. Are the services meeting their manpower requirements right now, General Davidson, as best as you know?
They are, and it's a testament, I think, more to the young Americans out there rather than some of our programs, which are not quite as contemporary as perhaps they should be in terms of public relations and recruiting. But the young people in America are so good, we can't mess this up. If we explain it properly and if we lead the nation properly, they will be there when we need them. And they have been so far.
You're saying that the armed forces are meeting their needs despite its efforts to do so. We have another question from our audience in Fort Dix. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, yes. My name is Susan Crawford, and I have a question for Colonel Dynan. You say you train soldiers for the challenges that they'll face when they go overseas, but how do you prepare the families and support the families while their spouses are gone?
Susan, that's a great question. Each unit has a family care organization embedded into it, and each of the units that come through the mobilization station have a rear detachment officer that's assigned for that purpose. So that officer, senior NCO, stays back with the unit to help manage the family programs while the rest of the unit goes forward. And that's something that's very ongoing, and I think we can't underestimate, you know, the complexity of that for the family members, because it is different from being assigned to Fort Bragg or Fort Stewart, where the families pretty much are either right on the installation or nearby. In the reserve component system, they're spread throughout the state or the region. So it's a decentralized effort, and we go back to where the home stations are located, to where those family networks kind of are based out of.
I mean, the difference when we hear from folks from Massapequa Park or Fairfield, Connecticut, is those aren't base towns where there are entire communities of people who've shipped out. They're individuals who may have come over with someone else, but not with a large number of folks from that community. A special challenge for this base.
Yeah, and it can get worse before it gets better. You remember there was a book out a couple of years ago called The Bedford Boys that on the D-Day invasion in Normandy, 19 people from Bedford, Virginia, were killed in the first 2 hours of the invasion, because when you recruit in the National Guard, you recruit from a single community. So losses in a unit, and losses tend to come together by unit, can be devastating on small towns. And I know that one of the units, I'm looking at the colonel's training schedule here, I'm looking over his shoulder, the 138th Field Artillery, who is here now, was one of three combat units to go to Vietnam. They were recruited from Bardstown, Kentucky, in a very, very bad night at a firebase Tomahawk. We lost five soldiers from the Kentucky Guard in one night. So casualties can fall very hard on guard units.
How do you approach that issue, Colonel Dynan, in training? That is, you're obviously training people for what you hope will be a successful experience when they're overseas, but they're going to experience setbacks and perhaps the odd catastrophe. How do you work that into the training regimen?
So that's absolutely embedded into the theater immersion training concept, as we train, as we fight. Three parts to that. One is the personnel recovery training. Another part is it's simulated training. Simulated evacuations and injuries and casualties occur throughout the training cycle here for everyone, as well as real live data coming in twice a week from the field, from theater. So there's several parts to it in terms of the training, but a lot of the casualty hands-on, while it's simulated, it's very real. And that's all part of, I think, the psychological training as one can best be prepared going into that theater.
And as the worst of the Iraq experiences, the Fallujahs, as they occurred, were you actually incorporating scenarios like that into what's happening at the forward operating base?
Yes, sir. The training organization does.
They do that.
Yes, sir.
I'm curious about the experience of people coming back. Do you debrief to find out whether or not the troops felt that their training was adequate to the task and left them in good shape?
Yes, sir, and I can use an example. We had a Charlie Battery 147 FA from Yankton, South Dakota. Mm-hmm. They were the first Sec 4 unit to come back this year. And part of their six-day demobilization phase on the ground was to conduct an after-action review out at the FOB. And it was fascinating to see where we had 250 soldiers and leaders that are part of the training process at that time, you know, give a standing ovation to the 15 soldiers from Charlie Battery as they led a three-hour session and an after-action review, what worked out well, what didn't, how they modified it. And it was an incredible experience.
And the course was modified based on what they said?
Sir, it's constant feedback, constant improvement. It's a continuous improvement environment that we have here.
General Davidson, you were about to add something?
I'm impressed with the fact that when I came through Fort Dix as a regular Army private of infantry a mere 30-some years ago, the village out there was a Vietnamese village because we were all training. We were going to the infantry, and we were going to go to Vietnam. We are worlds better now than we were then, worlds better.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're talking with retired General Mike Davidson and Colonel Douglas Dinan at Fort Dix. A similarity between the Vietnam experience and the Iraq experience is that our uniformed forces are fighting an insurgency that doesn't come in organized units wearing uniforms and insignia. How do you instill in your troops who are being trained here, Colonel Dinan, an appropriate mistrust of the people around them once they get into the theater, while not alienating people who indeed are friendly to U.S. forces?
Again, sir, part of the training here, one of the key tenets, part of the battle drills, is the escalation of force. And these are those sequential actions where non-lethal measures are applied. And since we've got the civilians on the battlefield that are part of the training on a regular basis, each unit has an embedded Iraqi interpreter. All that's part of the problem play, part of the continuum training that takes place here.
Caller next. It's Greg from Saranac Lake, New York.
Greetings, gentlemen.
Greetings.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say that I was a staff sergeant, New York Army National Guard. Did 5 months training at Fort Drum, New York. We're going to the desert, and we did all of our training in the middle of winter from October through January. 85% of the training that myself and my unit got while we were at Fort Drum was basically useless back in 2003, carried over to beginning part of 2004. The best training that we got was in JRTC for 2 weeks in January.
Now, where was that? You have to spell that out for us.
JRTC is the Joint Readiness Training Center down in Fort Polk, Louisiana. That was the best training that we got. I guess my question is, why aren't there more troops that are coming back? The military preaches train the trainer, and why aren't there more troops that have come back that are the ones that are doing the training?
Colonel Dinan, but why not? Why not?
The second part of the question, I guess, would be that when we got over in country, we did one right seat ride with the unit we were with, and then they left. So we were basically on our own to relearn what they already learned, and why wouldn't there have been, or is there more overlap now with the units that are going in?
Colonel Dinan.
Yeah, Craig, my understanding, once we have the deployment from Fort Dix, for example, units will go into Kuwait for approximately 2 to 3 weeks. Part of the program, too, is once they move forward up into Iraq, that there is a overlap of a training period with their handoff unit, and my understanding is it's approximately 30 days.
He was describing a much shorter transition there with the handoff unit.
We did have the time in Kuwait, but our overlap with our unit, I was with Charlie Company 2108 attached to the Big Red 1 in Samara. We were there. We were the one that had the, I don't know if anybody's heard, they say it's all over the Pentagon, the Easter Sunday battle in Samara, Iraq. That was the unit that I was with. Nathan Brown was killed on April 11th, 2004. And we had one right seat ride where we actually saw action that night, and then the unit that we had left. So even though we were in Kuwait and we had some training there, our overlap with the actual unit we were replacing on the ground in Samara at FOB Brassfield Mora was not anything more than a week. My question is, has that changed?
Has it changed? Thank you very much for the question, by the way.
Yes, Craig, I'd like to add a significant change here under First Army is that we've got each unit has SIPRNet access with its counterpart in theater, both counterpart and higher headquarters. Many units send representatives from theater here to work with the units while they're at the mobilization station, and it's a requirement to have a secure VTC video teleconference as part of the training piece here. So a lot of that right seat ride begins here at the MOB station.
Well, we need to take a short break now, but we will talk more with Colonel Douglas Dynan and with Major General Mike Davidson and take a few last questions from our audience on shipping at. Plus, we'll try to make the experience a little bit funny with the help of comedian Tom Irwin. I'm Robert Siegel, live at Fort Dix, New Jersey, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're talking with soldiers and their families about getting ready for war. And still with us are Colonel Douglas Dynan, a deputy commander for mobilization here at Fort Dix, and also retired Major General Michael Davidson, former assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for National Guard Matters. Caller next. It's Robert calling from Athens, Georgia.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I was in the 25th Infantry Division, 1st Brigade, in Charlie Company 15. I just want to say first before I start that I completely agree with the last caller saying that the right sea rides were completely insufficient because I was in the infantry too and we didn't go through anything. But the main reason why I wanted to call was to say that a lot of the equipment that the soldiers are going over there with is either broken or insufficient. It's not working. It's not combat effective at all. Me, for example, my M4 wouldn't work because the gas regulator was broken. So it would double feed after every shot. And I was told just to clean it, even though I would have my first sergeant inspected, I had my platoon sergeant inspected, and they'd all say, I mean, it couldn't be the fact that it wasn't clean that it didn't work. And, I mean, there's a million stories like that where the soldiers are going over with ineffective equipment.
Well, let's ask Colonel Dynan whether there are a million stories or not. Are there a lot of stories like that?
Yes. I mean,
well, let's hear the answer from Colonel Dynan. Do you hear him? Do you hear complaints of that sort from servicemen?
Sir, not recently. Our focus here at the mobilization station is we provide technical inspections for the equipment. The M4 is a carbine 5.56 rifle. A lot of them are brand new that we issue out. We put on the additional sights and so forth, but they get technically inspected before they're able to be used here at the firing range. So as far as communication or weapons, what's taking place in theater, you know, I'm not getting that feedback. What we do is we qualify and validate everything here at the MOB station.
Robert raised the question of the rides. I just want you to explain, for those of us who are unfamiliar with this, what are the kind of right-side rides that he's talking about?
Yes, both Craig and Robert referred to, it's kind of like cross-training. It's cross-training with your counterparts that you're going to take the job over from them. So it's a right seat ride with your counterparts. You understand what they've been facing, living with, you know, during their tour, which is 11 to 12 months on theater, boots on the ground. So it's a crossover period.
And Robert, you didn't find that sufficient, you're saying?
Oh, I didn't at all. When we got over there, the unit that we replaced was bombed within 3 days. We hardly had time to even get settled in. Only like our platoon sergeant went on one right sea ride with them. We went out there with no, I had just graduated from basic training, so we went over there with pretty much no experience whatsoever.
Mike Davidson, it sounds like from Robert's experience, you're trying to climb onto a fast-moving vehicle for that right seat ride.
It's tough, but let me put this in perspective, if I can, for just a moment. Robert, if you had signed into the 25th Division in Vietnam, you would have reported in as an individual. You would have met the people in your unit while you were in combat. And I know the right seat rides are not as good as we would want them to be, but at least we're there now. You're going over as units with unit cohesion. You know your leaders. You probably have confidence in your leaders. So we're not where we want to be, but we're making good progress.
Okay, thank you. Robert, we have a question from the audience here at Fort Dix.
Hi, how are you doing? I was mobilized in OIF-4. Is there any plan in the works to make the mobilization here on base or any other base time shorter? Because I was away from my family for a year and a half.
For a year and a half.
Yes, that's a great question. First Army hosted a conference last week with the intention of what variables, both pre-SRP, pre-deployment, individual training, collective training? What tasks could be moved forward and validated at home station prior to coming to the MOB station? So absolutely, that initiative is underway.
Do you expect to go back again to Iraq, sir?
Yes, I have no problem going back at all, sir.
But you'd prefer a shorter stay?
Yes, like in the mobilization site, before we went downrange, we were here for like a month. I just didn't know if there's any way to make that shorter, do weapons qual at the base, at the unit I was from, anything like that.
Mike Davidson, any last words of wisdom for our questioner?
Let me just start. We've been trying to solve that problem for 5 years, and we've not made a lot of progress at it. It's a bureaucracy doing stupid things, and I'd like to tell you it's going to get better. It probably won't. But let me bring out something that came out of Robert's call. There is no other army in the world where an enlisted guardsman can get up in a public forum and give the Secretary of Defense down the road about up-armoring Humvees. There's no army in the world that gives the kind of initiative and support to their enlisted soldiers that we do. So it's great to point out these problems because we can't fix them unless you point them out. But let's not lose sight of the fact of the high quality people we have in uniform that'll stand up on their hind legs and say things like, Mr. Secretary, mm-hmm. why am I out getting scrap metal and welding it to my Humvee myself? Now, that's a great army.
The moment of questioning was the great army part, you're saying, not the moment of scavenging for sheet metal to put on. We have, speaking of men in uniform, one more question from a member of our audience here in Fort Dix. Sir.
Eric Wagner, Poconos, Pennsylvania. This pertains to the Guard and Reserve. Are there programs for the soldiers and their families dealing with post-traumatic stress once that soldier returns home?
And I should add here that NPR aired a report just a few days ago out of Fort Carson, Colorado, that was not very encouraging about the support that returning soldiers who did suffer from PTSD were receiving there. What should they be receiving, Colonel Dinan? Do you know?
Well, what they do receive, sir, here at the mobilization station, part of the DMO process, is several iterations of training that take place. There's a very specific chaplain's reintegration program, but that's really the start of it. There's only so much that we're going to be able to do to introduce the soldier to the concept, as well as follow-on care provided by TRICARE and other VA systems once they're back at home station, back at their state. So it's not a single point-in-time answer for it. That's the one that gets introduced at the DMOB station, and it gets carried through by the VA back at home station.
Well, Colonel Douglas Dinan and General Mike Davidson, thanks to both of you for answering some important and a couple of difficult questions talking about training for war here at Fort Dix and elsewhere. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Mr. Steele.